So the essential idea behind these various principles is simple. We are living beings who depend on breathable air, drinkable water, and fertile soil. We cannot breathe, drink, or eat money. Having more money does not make us richer if we have less air, water, and soil. How simple is that? A society that destroys its essential means of living to make money for a privileged few can hardly claim to be intelligent or civilized.
That's David Corton, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Corton on Beyond Money. Money, you know, as they say, is the root of all evil. The pursuit of it, no matter the consequences, has led to our, as the New York Times describes it, speeding toward environmental catastrophe. Unregulated predatory capitalism and its obsession with generating profits, no matter the cost to nature, is endangering civilization as we know it. Globally, people, young people in particular, are demanding action. Teenagers like Greta Thunberg, Shia Bastida, Haven Coleman, Isra Hirsi, Alexandria Villaseñor, and groups like the Sunrise Movement, Extinction Rebellion, and 350.org are leading the way and working for a future that is safe and secure from climate disruption. All over the world, in late September and going forward, there will be strikes, walkouts, and other actions. We must move from a money-oriented society to one in harmony with and respect for the Earth. Our guest today is David Corton. He was an insider in the development establishment for several decades. He worked for the Ford Foundation and USAID and taught at Harvard University's Graduate School of Business. Having severed his ties to the past, today he is a leading voice for climate and social justice. He's the author of When Corporations Rule the World, Agenda for a New Economy, and Change the Story, Change the Future. He spoke in Kirkland, Washington. And now, David Corton.
We've got a very big topic. We are now in humanity's ultimate moment of truth. Here's a brief overview of our current human situation. By the estimates of the Global Footprint Network, the human species currently consumes at a rate 1.7 times what Earth's regenerative systems can sustain. So essentially, we're consuming at the rate of what it will require 1.7 planets to support. So anything over one planet is a problem because it means all that extra is consumed at the price of destroying Earth's capacity to support life. Now, at the same time as the environmental crisis has been building, a few folks have been doing extremely well. I'm sure some of you heard this statistic, that there are now six individuals in the world whose financial assets are equivalent to the poorest half of humanity. So that's six individuals in this hand and 3.9 billion in this hand. So you may not have a fetish about the importance of equality, but how much inequality is too much? Well, I actually should note, you probably know, you may have thought of this as I mentioned the six individuals. The two richest individuals in the world live a short drive from where we are right now. Some of you here may work for them or know them, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. So meanwhile, billions of people face a desperate struggle to meet the daily needs for food, water, and shelter in a global economy that gives them little or no support. The patterns are similar in much of the world, as environmental and social breakdown renders ever more places uninhabitable and drives growing millions of desperate people to abandon their homes and seek refuge in a far distant place. Some hope to find their refuge here in the United States, the self-proclaimed richest country in the world, in which 4 out of 10 people are not well enough off to cover a $400 emergency. Given what's playing out, it comes as no surprise that the institutions by which we govern ourselves have lost legitimacy. And you may have noticed what the cost of that is. Looking ahead, the world's dominant trends are mostly in the wrong direction. Yet even within the inner circle of global activists to which I'm privileged to belong, the discussions seemed hopelessly limited. There's been far too little discussion of the imperative for a deep transformation of our most powerful institutions, far beyond sterile debates about the relative merits of capitalism versus socialism. Suddenly, however, in late 2018, I began to sense that something profound was shifting. Opportunities for serious conversation began to emerge in ways I've not previously experienced. Then a few weeks ago, talk of climate change seemed to erupt everywhere, from the national news to local meetings in our community around Bainbridge. And I understand that's happening around much of the country and much of the world. I now find myself engaged in some of the most potentially significant conversations of my life. One involves a Vatican initiative to transform management and economics education in the world's Jesuit universities. The goal is to align these courses, these programs, with the moral principles of Pope Francis' encyclical on the environment, Laudato Si. It seems the Vatican recognizes that it's a very bad idea to use our educational institutions to indoctrinate our youth in the idolatry of money, to the neglect of the well-being of people and planet. I hope this may be a leading-edge initiative awakening to the need to transform the world's institutions of higher learning. Serious reform in these most serious, most prestigious of human institutions is long overdue. Another exciting conversation is in the Club of Rome, which is an international group of influential new paradigm thinkers, of which I am privileged to be a member. For years, the club has actually been slipping into irrelevance. Now, we're under new leadership. Happens to be two women. First time we've had women leaders for this institution. And immediately, the group is launching 3 new initiatives. The first is on the climate emergency. The second is on the imperative of a human transition to a new civilization. And the third is on a new economics to guide the human path to the new civilization. Yet another initiative is in China, which has written into its constitution its commitment to transition to an ecological civilization. Calling for a civilizational transformation makes clear we are talking about far more than a few adjustments in our culture and institutions. This is deep transformation in which virtually everything we know must change, at least everything in how we relate to one another and to Earth. We easily could spend our time together this evening listing all the reasons why such a grand effort is futile and certainly doomed to failure. The power of corporations and global financial markets is just too great. The institutions of corporations and financial markets, however, are human institutions. And what humans create humans can change. There's nothing immute about it. But the creative action we need must be born of possibility, not of fear. People must be inspired by a realistic vision of a possible world of peace, a vibrantly beautiful and healthy natural environment, and material sufficiency and spiritual abundance for all of Earth's people. And my intention this evening is to take you on an exploration of the potential of our human nature and the possible path to an ecological civilization. It surely will not be easy to achieve globally what no single nation has yet achieved locally. Yet we face an imperative to do just that. The consequence, if we embrace the challenge and fail, fortunately will be no worse than the consequence of failing to try. So let's get on and give it a try. The journey ahead begins with the recognition that humans are a species with significantly unrealized potential. Our realization of that potential begins by recognizing the fundamental nature and potential of life itself. The pioneering biologist Lynn Margulis once observed that life is matter with the power to choose. Life is matter with the power to choose. She was speaking to life's power of agency, action, choice. It is an observation at once simple, self-evident, profound, and long denied by Western science. The fact that's fortunately beginning to change, but that's very, very recent. Matter possessed of agency is a living organism. Matter without agency is simply dead matter. And among all known organisms, we humans have a capacity for agency, for self-determination far beyond that of any other species known to us. That capacity, our capacity to choose, including our capacity to choose our nature and our future, is so integral to our human experience that we easily forget the distinctive responsibilities that come with it. While all living creatures have agency, our human agency is distinctive because of our distinctive cognitive facilities. We know ourselves by the stories we share. The contrasting stories of the world's varied cultures lead to sometimes profound differences in the ways in which humans of different cultures have lived in different times and settings with outcomes ranging from beautiful and inspiring to disastrously self-destructive. That we currently organize as a global species around an intellectually and morally corrupt story championed by 20th century economics explains in large measure why we are now on a path to self-extinction. Our story problem actually begins with the mechanistic frame of a science story that denies the existence of consciousness and intelligent agency. In its denial of life's most essential characteristic, it strips life of its beauty, meaning, and purpose, and absolves us of responsibility for the harms our choices inflict on others. It also sets us up to be seduced by the expertly cultivated illusions of a consumer society, in which corporations profit from selling us products for which we have no real need, and the production and use of which may cause great harm to other people and Earth, and of course, even to ourselves. Now, people sometimes tell me they don't understand an economics that celebrates profligate consumption as being good for society. It doesn't make sense to them. I commonly reply that this suggests that they do understand economics, at least as it is currently taught and practiced. Because, as currently taught and practiced, economics doesn't make any sense. Economics went astray back in the 19th century. A group of economists were eager to raise the intellectual status of economics to a science equivalent to physics. So they turned away from Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx, who all maintained that value begins with labor. Ignoring that foundational insight, they embraced instead a theoretical framework borrowed from physics that takes no account of our essential nature or our needs as living beings. Looking for a readily available metric to plug into their models, they embraced money as their defining value and chose to value life only for its market price. Ultimately, these economists invented a fantasy world in which money is wealth and a storehouse of value. In this imaginary world, wealth is created by making money. And there are no limits to growth and consumption because if some natural resource is in short supply, markets will respond to provide an equal or better substitute. Thus, they urge policymakers to prioritize policies that maximize corporate profits. Regarding individuals, they assert that it is actually the moral responsibility of each of us to maximize our personal financial gain without regard to the consequences for others or for Earth. If you think economics doesn't make any sense, you've got it right. Does any of this make any sense? No. But these presumptions are easily reduced to mathematical models, so in the eyes of a conventional economist, that makes them scientific. The resulting economics is less a science than a religion dedicated to what Pope Francis properly calls the idolatry of money. These presumptions present a striking contrast with the real world, in which money has value only to the extent another person is willing to accept it for something of actual value. In fact, money is just a number. Growing that number creates only a larger number. And storing that number, irrespective of its size, does nothing to assure that tomorrow's children will have a living earth. Real wealth is that which is essential to the well-being of life. It begins with the air, water, and soil that Earth provides. It includes the energy that comes from the Earth's sun and the regenerative systems of a finite Earth and the finite products of nature's labor. To fully understand the insidious power of the assumptions of economics, we need also to understand the nature of human institutions, including the formal institutions of money, business, government, religion, and the nation-state, all of which have such decisive influence in shaping our relationships to one another and Earth. These institutions are all relatively recent creations of the human mind, and they exist only in the human mind. This is something I didn't realize until actually I started preparing this presentation. And yet it is so obvious and it is so foundational once you begin to absorb it. Early humans lived without these institutions for nearly 200,000 years. Nature has no evident counterparts. Even modern humans cannot recognize them until educated to do so. We create the institutions, then they teach us back what to value. So what are our institutions of education, religion, and media teaching us to value? Do they teach us to value institutions that serve life or that serve money? That support cooperation or competition? that enhance the well-being of communities or the profits of corporations? These are foundational questions for humanity, particularly for our institutions of higher learning through which we prepare our future business, government, political, religious, and intellectual leaders. Overall, higher education courses teach a mechanistic conceptual frame that denies our agency and ultimately denies our responsibility for the well-being of one another and Earth. Simply put, human institutions are products of the shared stories by which we define ourselves and our relationships with one another and Earth. In turn, these institutions reinforce the assumptions of those stories. If we get our shared story wrong, we get our institutions wrong. If we get our institutions wrong, we get our future wrong. And we now have them all terribly wrong. Because human institutions are purely human creations, there is no reason for them to exist other than to serve us. And they currently do so to our extreme peril. Hope lies with our ability to shed or transform these institutions by changing the narrative that sustains them and that they in turn reinforce. Flawed narratives and the institutions they legitimate can hold sway long beyond their useful life. Yet seemingly invincible institutions can quickly shatter once the story that sustains them loses credibility. Think of the sudden disintegration of the Soviet Union and the collapse of apartheid in South Africa as the legitimacy of the institutions that had long endured suddenly disintegrated. It is much easier, however, to bring down failed institutions grounded in a failed narrative than it is to replace them with institutions grounded in a new narrative. That is because it is easier for us to agree on what we are against than to agree on what we are for. Moving forward needs broad agreement on a new story that recognizes our dependence on one another and nature. We need agreement on the characteristics of the institutions needed to support relationships of mutual service and commitment. And we need agreement on the path by which we seek to advance from the old to the new. This takes us back to the need for a new economics that respects the questions most foundational to our existence. What is life? What is life as we know it? And on what does life's well-being depend? The Zulu people of southern Africa have a name for it, Ubuntu. I am because we are. I am because we are. Not necessarily you as an individual, but you as my community. Over billions of years, the ancestors of Earth's countless living species brought life to Earth and Earth to life. That life depends on the constant labor of Earth's countless organisms to continuously regenerate the conditions essential to life's existence in a constant struggle to counter the forces of entropy. Labor, human and non-human, physical and intellectual, is the essence of life as it continuously adapts to the ever-changing conditions on Earth's surface. For me, the source of this most fundamental insight into life's nature traces to my meeting a bit more than 20 years ago with a remarkable microbiologist, Dr. Mae-Wan Ho. She introduced me to the miracle of the human body. And it is all so obvious once pointed out. We each depend on our earthly existence for our living body. This is what she taught me. And my body as yours depends on the continuous self-organizing labor of tens of trillions of individual cells and microorganisms, each dedicated to creating and maintaining the body that is the vessel of our individual consciousness and the instrument of our individual agency. Think about that. Each of your bodies, you are here, you are alive, you are aware. You are able to intervene and contribute to the recovery of the earth we've been destroying because of these tens of trillions of individual living beings in your body, each making continuous decisions and relating in ways essential to our existence. Now think of these bodily processes as an analogy for how Earth's countless species labor to create and maintain the regenerative process that bring Earth to life. In living systems, real wealth, the wealth on which both human and non-human life depends, is the product of labor. We're talking here of an expanded version of the labor theory of value framed by those original classical economists, notably including Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx. Let us now ask, which system of economic organization will better serve us? Capitalism or socialism? At least that's the way we commonly frame the question. Yet in contemporary society, we assume that this choice between capitalism and socialism comes down to the question of whether capital should be owned by global corporations or by national governments. If capital is owned by global corporations, we call it capitalism. If capital is owned by a national government, we call it socialism or communism. And of course, those governments are often ruled by dictators. So the dictator, better or worse than the CEO. No. Either way, narrowing it to that simplistic choice evades the more essential question. Do the returns from labor go primarily to those who provide the labor that creates the real value? Or do they go to those who claim ownership of the product of the labor, even though they may contribute nothing to its creation? If they contribute nothing, then they are expropriating the value created by others. Under capitalism, as we currently know and practice it, the system is pretty much dedicated to assuring that the returns do not go to those who created the actual value. That problem is inherent in any situation where labor and ownership are separated. You see where I'm going? Note how easily this can be corrected by a slight structural adjustment. Assign to workers the ownership rights to the value they produce. We call that worker ownership. Not only does that mean that returns go to the people who earn them, it assures that wealth and power are equitably distributed and that the ownership of assets resides in the communities that depend on them. It is an essential condition for democracy to work, which our current democracy clearly does not.
You're listening to David Korten on Beyond Money. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
Under true worker ownership, each community controls its own means of production and has a natural incentive to use its labor and resources in ways consistent with the long-term well-being of the community's people and natural systems. We could call it democratic capitalism. We could call it worker capitalism. Or we could call it worker socialism. Take your pick. It's not the name. It's the connection of ownership and labor. Now, we must be clear that worker ownership can achieve the needed result for society only if the worker owners embrace their responsibility to the community for the well-being of the whole. If they model themselves as conventional capitalist owners responsible only for maximizing their personal profits, the result will ultimately be much the same for as they are for conventional capitalism. So whatever we call the system, the rights, powers, and responsibilities of ownership properly reside with those who provide the physical and mental labor essential to the well-being of people and planet. That includes the vast bulk of both humanity and nature. that the existing system gives that control instead to the tiny minority of people who control society's money and empowers them to deny others access to a means of living is a moral travesty that bears major responsibility for the current human crisis. To take without giving is the moral code of the cancer cell. In a healthy living community, all beings have agency, all contribute, and all benefit. It is the way of community, it is the way of life. The challenge at hand is to transition from an economy of exploitation to an economy of service by applying principles of a well-being economy. Principle one, evaluate the economy's performance by indicators of the well-being of people and planet, not the growth of GDP. That's pretty simple, isn't it? We get what we measure, so choose to measure what we actually want. If our goal is to increase the financial assets of the rich so they can claim an ever-growing share of what remains of Earth's real wealth, then by all means we should keep the focus on growing GDP. But if our priority is to meet the essential needs for food, water, shelter, and other basics for all the world's people, then we best recognize that we share a finite planet with finite regenerative capacity that must be maintained and shared. So put GDP behind us. Focus instead on measures of progress toward achieving what we actually want. Okay, that was principle one. Principle two. Labor only for that which benefits life, not for that which destroys life. That should be pretty simple too, shouldn't it? Well, war and the preparations for war are prime examples of ends to which we should not apply our labor. They harm both people and nature while producing no benefit to either. We also misapply our labor to promote advertising that encourages people to purchase harmful or unneeded products. We could do without that. We could also do without the work of financial speculators who use massive computer power and energy to no beneficial purpose. We can reduce humanity's earth burden by eliminating labor involving the release of toxic chemicals into soil, air, and water to achieve temporary increases in crop yields at the expense of Earth's generative capacities and our human health. In so doing, we also reduce the need to expend labor and physical resources on medical care that otherwise is needed to resolve health problems created by the toxins in our air, water, and food. We can eliminate the need for labor devoted to the manufacture and operation of automobiles by designing infrastructure to support people living close to where they work, shop, and play. We can eliminate much of the vastly destructive global movement of people and goods by keeping production and consumption local, relying on recycled materials, and substituting electronic communication for global travel. Hold on, says the 20th century economist. You're eliminating jobs. The 21st century economist says, yes. But there are so many other ways the people liberated from these jobs can be put to work to advance the well-being of people and planet. Oh. These include caring for and educating our children, caring for the elderly, restoring the health and vitality of Earth's regenerative systems, and rebuilding infrastructures in ways that reduce dependence on fossil fuels and simultaneously strengthen our beneficial connections with one another and nature. Then the 20th century economists object, but that will generate less profit. The 21st century economist responds, we don't need more profit, we need more well-being. Oh. Principle three. Honor and reward all who provide beneficial labor, including nature, not those who merely exploit life's labor to grow financial assets. Our existence depends on life's labor. We earn our right to share in the surplus of the whole through our paid and unpaid labor and service to the whole. The presumptive owners of natural capital have no inherent entitlement. their reward must be in proportion to their labor in ensuring or enhancing nature's regenerative yield. And their reward must be in proportion to their labor in sustaining or enhancing nature's regenerative yield. This is basically the concept of use rights that is common in traditional societies. The current economic system directs the rewards to those who claim ownership of the capital that labor produces. The obvious fix is worker ownership of the capital on which their living depends, not through some distant government, but through direct worker community cooperative ownership. This will end society's division between a wealthy lending class and an indentured borrowing class. What about the question of setting a time when we retire from work? I find this a very interesting question. There's an 81-year-old that finds life as much more dynamic if I don't retire. Retirement from service to the community that sustains us all comes only at the moment of death. To retire from service at an early age is to seek early death. Aging is different. Here we can learn from indigenous peoples how to transform into roles of elder, teacher, and wisdom keeper of the community at the appropriate time in our lives. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean we have to be paid in our old age. It's just that we never outgrow our need and responsibility to be engaged and to be contributing. Principle 4, create society's money supply through a transparent public process to advance the common good, not through secret processes that grow the profits of for-profit banks. In a modern society in which access to the essentials of life depends on money, those who control the creation and allocation of money control the lives of everyone. It defies reason to assume that society will benefit from giving this power to global for-profit banks dedicated only to generating profits for the already richest among us. That power must be public, transparent, and accountable to the people whose living depends on access to money. It must reside in democratic governments, ideally supplemented by individual community-owned cooperative banks through which local people aggregate their savings to finance loans to support local home and business ownership. Principle 5, educate for a lifetime of learning and service to life-seeking communities, not for service to profit-seeking corporations. Life is labor. So too, life is learning. Learning and sharing. No one knows how to go where we humans now must go. Education cannot provide us with answers we do not have. It can, however, prepare us to be lifelong learners, skilled in making the right and asking the right questions and in working together to find and share answers appropriate to our specific situation. This is a very different process than teaching students to compete to provide the largest number of textbook-approved answers on a standardized test. Principle 6, create and apply technology only to serve life, not to destroy or displace it. Technology must be life's servant, not life's master. Most technologies have potential for varied applications, some beneficial to life and some harmful to life. To choose applications based solely on which will produce the greatest financial return is collective madness. Humans have the right and the means to favor the development and application of technology to reduce destructive environmental impacts, restore the regenerative capacity of Earth's systems, and facilitate global understanding, cooperation, and learning as we transition to an ecological civilization. Principle 7. Organize as cooperative, self-reliant, regenerative communities that share knowledge and technology to serve life, not as incorporated pools of money competing to grow by exploiting life. Nature's economy self-organizes everywhere as self-reliant local communities that maintain constant cyclical flows of resources to meet local needs with minimal need for the distant inputs provided by specialized species like migratory birds and fish. Except for toxins that nature sequesters and energy that the sun continuously renews, everything in nature is reused and recycled in perpetuity as the wastes of one become food for another. Up until less than 100 years ago, humans did much the same. We can learn to do it again. Urban and rural dwellers will rediscover their interdependence as cities meet their needs for food, timber, fiber, and pulp from nearby rural areas, and rural areas regenerate their soils with biowaste from nearby urban areas. Cities will provide cultural and educational opportunities for both urban and rural dwellers. Rural dwellers will provide urban dwellers with food, water, and nature immersion experiences, including summer agriculture work opportunities for urban youth. Suburbs that now occupy massive tracts of land for low density, low interaction, energy and efficient living will convert to either high density, high interaction, energy efficient urban habitats or low density, high nature intensive rural habitats. This will improve resource efficiency and quality of life while restoring natural regenerative capacity. As cities restructure to eliminate dependence on cars, people will walk, cycle, and use public transportation, meeting and greeting on the streets, in sidewalk cafes, and in parks with beautiful gardens. The car-free cities of an ecological civilization will feature multi-generational, multi-family living units that function as vibrant eco-communities, sharing facilities, tools, resources, and labor, with residents looking out for one another and their children as intact tribal communities still do. Principle 8. Seek a mutually beneficial population balance between humans and Earth's other species, not the dominance of humans over all others. The health of any natural ecosystem depends on its ability to balance the populations of its varied species. While we do not fully understand how these dynamics work in nature, populations are constrained by interactions among species and the limitations of the resources on which they all depend. Just as healthy bodies mobilize against rogue cancer cells, ecosystems mobilize against rogue species. This dynamic suggests that either humans will self-manage their reproduction and distribution to align with Earth's needs and capabilities, or Earth will define us as a rogue species and attempt to eliminate us, which may already be happening. To voluntarily control our population numbers, we can provide educational and occupational opportunities for women and make fertility management methods freely available to all who seek them. To manage our population distribution, we can facilitate voluntary resettlement from over to underpopulated countries and localities. So the essential idea behind these various principles is simple. We are living beings who depend on breathable air, drinkable water, and fertile soil. We cannot breathe, drink, or eat money. Having more money does not make us richer if we have less air, water, and soil. How simple is that? A society that destroys its essential means of living to make money for a privileged few can hardly claim to be intelligent or civilized. Modest personal adjustments will not correct the failures of an inherently dysfunctional cultural and institutional system. Our future depends on a unified human effort dedicated to driving deep change, for example. Instead of stopping the use of plastic bags, create an economy that produces no waste. Instead of buying an electric car, design neighborhoods to do away with our need for cars. Instead of buying organic, Create a food system in which all food is produced in ways good for earth and healthy for people. Instead of accepting all immigrants at the border, create a world in which every person has a place. Instead of growing GDP, grow the well-being of people and planet. Instead of asking corporations to be responsible, break up concentrations of corporate power and render the pieces accountable to the communities in which they do business by converting them to worker and community ownership. Instead of protesting a current or proposed war, dismantle the apparatus of war and the military-industrial complex. The step to an ecological civilization requires a public dialogue to affirm the story that has lived in the human heart since the beginning of time, a story of the possibilities of life, love, beauty, and creativity, a story that can lead us to the culture and institutions of a new civilization, an ecological civilization of material sufficiency and spiritual abundance for all. That conversation begins in the place where we live. From there, it can grow in ways that ultimately connect all of humanity in a common commitment to creating a world in which people and nature live together in mutual peace and prosperity. Ubuntu, I am because we are. United we live, divided we perish. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Thank you.
David, you provided a wonderful vision of the future that we should be looking toward. Resisting that future is an incredible power structure that you alluded to. And the gap I'm feeling at the end of the talk is how do we fight that power? That concentration of wealth is the concentration of political power, and people that have it aren't going to give it up readily.
How do we fight the system? You know, it's interesting, yeah. I mean, you think about it, the way the civil rights movement was won by Martin Luther King, it was not responding to violence with violence. And this is the thing that's so extraordinary in terms of what happened in South Africa. Now, it hasn't turned out as, I mean, there's still a lot of work to do, but I had this extraordinary experience. Apartheid was collapsing in South Africa. I was invited to go there to participate in a course for the members of the African Congress. The black Africans that had led the resistance, that had many of these that were in this course that I was involved in, had spent years in the prisons with Nelson Mandela. And the thing that just had such an impact on me was to hear these individuals who had borne the very worst of that say in a gentle voice the empathy they had for their oppressors, because they realized that their oppressors were oppressed, that their humanity was equally depressed by the system. That it was a system that it was dehumanizing all humans, regardless of their color. Now, somehow, this is what we must bring forward in our own minds and in our conversations, and into an ultimately global conversation. What does it truly mean to be human? What is the deepest expression of our humanity? What is the source of our deepest sense of our humanity, of worth, of well-being, of purpose? To be glad we're alive. And that can only be achieved by ending this oppression that oppresses both the winners and the losers, the top and the bottom. You know, it's an incredible level of understanding, particularly for those who have suffered the most on the bottom. But they, as those South African blacks, taught me the great source of wisdom and understanding.
Throughout history, when cultures and systems reach an extreme state, they break down, they self-destruct, and then there's chaos. And there's a new culture that arises, new values, new systems, new governance, and so on arise. But do we really have to repeat that chaotic phase of the cultural change that you're trying to achieve?
Do the cultures have to collapse before we can create the new? I don't know. I don't have a clear answer for that. What I have a dream. Where you have the collapse, well, as you had with the Soviet Union is a wonderful example. When it collapsed, the only alternative that they knew was capitalism. And you had a group of economists coming in from Harvard, actually from an institute that I worked for a time at Harvard, who taught them that the thing they needed was to go capitalist and corporations and all the kinds of stuff that creates the problems that we're dealing with now. And they had no other idea, so that's what they did, and we get what we get in Russia, which is generally a disaster. Now, the hope comes if we get fairly large, organized groups of people, and this is happening in many places around the world, who begin to organize locally, to rebuild their communities, rebuild their local economies, and so forth, so you can begin to create the alternative from the bottom up, so there is something to turn to rather than total chaos if the existing institutional system falls apart. So that, to me, is the frame of the strategy, which is why these conversations are so important. It's not just to discredit the failed system. It is to work together to find the alternative. Now, this relates to what do we do with our students in the university? We have to teach people how to learn, how to figure out how to do something that humans have never done before, at least on the kind of scale that we now have to do it. Because obviously small groups of people have done these sorts of things for a very long time. If we can shift our universities from, instead of being teaching institutions, become learning institutions, that would be a very important shift. But anyway, these are the kinds of problems that are beginning to flow out into the larger conversation. And they're the questions we have to ask, and there are no easy answers. Thank you.
You were just listening to David Corton on Beyond Money. He spoke in Kirkland, Washington in June 2019. David Corton is a leading voice for climate and social justice. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media organization Rise Up. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Chuck Collins, Winona LaDuke, Bill McKibben, Michael Yates, Dar Jamil, and Ralph Nader. We also have a series of David Corton programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.